Hello, and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's March 20th, 2016. It was in the early morning hours of this day in 2003 that forces from the United States, Britain, Australia, and Poland began military operations in Iraq. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. Pete Musto will bring us part one of his two-part report on the growing number of part-time college professors who are demanding full-time jobs. Then, Ana Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with words and their stories. This week, she tells us the meaning of some of the strange expressions in the book Alice in Wonderland. Have you ever wondered what the meaning of the expression mad as a hatter is? We'll tell you today. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we tell you the story of how the United States was dragged into World War I. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. Every day of the year, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And every Sunday, we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We are a little different here at VOA Learning English. Because we exist to help you learn everyday American English, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. A recent study finds that almost three-quarters of all faculty positions at American universities are part-time, adjunct, or temporary, but not tenure-track. The professors who aren't on the road to getting tenure or permanent, protected teaching positions are trying to change that. Pete Musto has part one of his two-part report on this important subject.
Christina McCoy is a professor who loves teaching 16th and 17th century Spanish literature. But after only 1 year of teaching at a university in Southern Virginia, she is leaving. McCoy received her doctorate degree, or PhD, from the University of Texas at Austin in 2015. She immediately looked for a teaching position. But McCoy quickly learned that finding a full-time job at any university was almost impossible.
When I entered graduate school in 2007, people were picking what cities they got to live in. They had multiple offers, and now there are four jobs in the whole country.
For McCoy and others like her, the world of higher education has changed. Tenured positions, or university teaching positions that last as long as a person wants to keep them, are disappearing. The Teachers Insurance and Annuity Association, or TIAA Institute, is an organization that studies financial issues for educators. A 2013 TIAA Institute report stated that over the past 30 years, U.S. colleges and universities have changed the types of jobs they offer. The report said 70% of all faculty positions are now part-time, adjunct, temporary, or full-time, but these jobs are not tenure track. Johns Hopkins University published a book in 2006 about higher education called The American Faculty. That book stated that in 1969, 80% of faculty positions across the country were tenured or tenure track. Teresa Politano has taught media studies part-time at Rutgers University in New Jersey since 1999. Politano says the university has never offered her a full-time tenure-track position. She also says the change in the kinds of faculty positions universities are offering is a big problem.
It's always been a poorly paid position, but in the past, I think the employee and the university viewed the position differently. It had an added value. Now what we're seeing is not only do we have a greater reliance by the university on part-time faculty, but we're also seeing a lot of part-timers who are working two or three or four or sometimes 8 to 10 different classes, and sometimes over 3 or 4 different universities in order to piece together a living.
Politano is also the president of the union representing part-time faculty at Rutgers. She fights so full-time and part-time faculty can receive equal pay for equal work. The union was able to negotiate a 5% pay increase from the administration in December. But, Politano says, not all faculty are so lucky. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Next week, in part 2 of his report, Pete will tell us about some of the difficulties colleges and universities face in trying to pay their professors more. Now, it's time for our popular weekly program, Words and Their Stories. Today, Anna Mateo tells us the meaning of some strange expressions from a strange book.
Hello, from VOA Learning English, this is Words and Their Stories. Many expressions that we use in American English come from movies and books. Today, we will explore expressions from Lewis Carroll's famous book, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. This book is better known as Alice in Wonderland. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was published in 1865. The story is about a young girl falling for a long time down a rabbit hole. When she finally lands, she finds herself in a strange world. In this strange world are some of the most recognizable characters in children's literature. Many of them, and other expressions from the book, have found their way into American English. The first character Alice meets is the White Rabbit. The White Rabbit is not your usual rabbit. First of all, he is wearing a vest and carrying a pocket watch. He also has somewhere very important to be. Running past Alice, he says, I'm late for a very important date. No time to say hello, goodbye, I'm late, I'm late, I'm late.
I'm late for a very important date. cutting deep. No time to say hello. Goodbye. I'm late.
Alice chases after him, and that is where her adventures begin. In English, chasing a white rabbit means to chase the impossible, a fantasy, a dream. In 1967, the rock band Jefferson Airplane wrote a song called White Rabbit. The song tells of Alice's adventures and hints that drugs are involved. But don't worry, you need not take drugs. Following the white rabbit means following an unlikely clue and finding yourself in the middle of an extraordinary situation. This situation often challenges your beliefs and changes your life. The white rabbit is so curious, so strange, that Alice cannot help but to follow him. As she chases after him, she falls down the rabbit hole into Wonderland. Like chasing a white rabbit, these days, to go down the rabbit hole does not have to mean taking drugs to change your reality. To fall down the rabbit hole can mean to enter a confusing situation. However, usually we use this expression to mean we got interested in something to the point of distraction. We lose all track of time. It often happens by accident and is about something not that meaningful. With this idiom, you can add details to further describe what type of rabbit hole you fell into, as in this example.
Where have you been? You were supposed to meet me here an hour ago.
I am so sorry. I was looking online for some advice on how to get a baby to fall asleep, and I fell into a rabbit hole of parenting blogs.
There are tens of thousands of those. It's a wonder you made your way out.
Going down the rabbit hole can also mean a strange state of mind. Later in the story, Alice is the guest at a tea party. A crazy tea party. There she meets the March Hare and the Hatter. They give her riddle after riddle, and both seem truly crazy. As with many expressions found in Carroll's books, Mad as a March Hare appeared in other places long before the publication of his book. Hares have long been thought to behave excitedly in March, which is their mating season. Scientifically, this may not be true, but to be mad as a March Hare means that someone is completely mad or crazy. The expression mad as a hatter also means to be completely crazy. Of the two, mad as a hatter is more common. But don't tell the March Hare. Who knows how he will react? Now we move on to the Cheshire Cat. Smiling like a Cheshire Cat was a common expression during Victorian times. Carroll brought this expression to life in his book with the character the Cheshire Cat. A person who is compared to the Cheshire Cat is sneaky, cunning, mischievous, unpredictable, and mysterious. Near the end of the story, Alice meets the Queen of Hearts. The Queen of Hearts is a foul-tempered monarch. She is quick to give the death sentence for the slightest wrongdoing by yelling, "Off with their heads! Off with their heads!" A woman who is called a Queen of Hearts is a control freak. She is a self-appointed Queen of Events. And she is an aggressive woman who tries to dominate everything and everyone around her. Using expressions from popular books can add a special flavor to your English. And when used properly, they also show you have a deeper understanding of the literature and culture of the English language. So have fun with them. And that's Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Found myself in Wonderland.
Thanks, Anna. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. The main issue in America's presidential election of 1916 was war. Europe was in the middle of what is now remembered as World War I. It was the bloodiest conflict the world had ever known. Most Americans wanted no part of the struggle in Europe. They supported their country's official position, neutrality. This desire was the main reason President Woodrow Wilson won re-election. People gave Wilson their votes because they hoped he would keep his promise to keep America out of the war. But as Larry West and Morris Joyce tell us now, that was a promise the president could not and would not keep.
Like most Americans, Woodrow Wilson did not want war. He feared that entering the conflict would cost the United States many lives. Wilson read the reports from European battlefields. The news was unbelievably terrible. By the end of 1916, several million men had been killed, wounded, or captured. At the Battle of Verdun, French forces stopped a German attack. The cost was high on both sides. More than 700,000 soldiers were killed, wounded, or captured. The Battle of the Somme followed. Britain lost 60,000 men on the first day. By the time the battle was over, losses for both sides totaled more than a million. Germany also was at war on its eastern border with Russia. Losses on that battlefront, too, totaled more than a million men.
At the time of America's presidential election in 1916, Germany seemed to be winning the war. Its losses were terrible. But the losses of its enemies, the Allies, were even worse. German forces occupied much of northern France and almost all of Belgium. German and Austrian soldiers also held parts of Russia, Italy, Romania, and Serbia. Germany was winning on the battlefield. The Allies were winning at sea. A British blockade cut off almost all German trade with the rest of the world. Even food shipments were blocked. As a result, Germany faced mass starvation. It urgently needed to break the blockade and get food.
This situation finally forced Germany to make the decision that would bring the United States into the war. It decided to use its submarines to break the British blockade. The submarines would attack any ships that came near Britain or other parts of Europe. This included ships from neutral countries like the United States. Earlier, Germany had made a promise to the United States. Its submarines would not attack civilian ships unless warning was given and the lives of those on the ships were saved. Now Germany was withdrawing that promise. It said unrestricted submarine warfare would begin immediately. German ruler Kaiser Wilhelm said, If Wilson wants war, let him make it, and let him then have it.
President Wilson immediately broke diplomatic relations with Germany. He still hoped the two nations would not go to war. He left that decision to Germany. If German submarines sank American ships, Wilson would have no choice but to declare war. Most American shipping companies feared attack by German submarines. Throughout the early part of 1917, they kept their ships in home ports. They wanted protection. So, they asked for permission to arm their ships. At first, President Wilson refused to seek such permission from Congress. He did not want to do anything that might cause Germany to declare war. Then he received secret news from Britain. British agents had gotten a copy of a telegram from Germany's foreign minister to Germany's ambassador in Mexico. The telegram said Germany was planning hostile acts against the United States. Wilson acted quickly. He began putting guns and sailors on American trade ships.
It did not take long for the worst to happen. Within days, a German submarine sank an unarmed American ship, the Algonquin. Then three more American ships were sunk. Many lives were lost. President Wilson no longer had a choice between war and peace. There would be war. Wilson called a special session of Congress. Members of both the Senate and House of Representatives gathered in one room. They stood as the president walked quickly to the front. He stood silent for a moment before speaking. This is what he said.
Fully understanding the serious step I am taking, I advise that the Congress declare the recent acts of the German government to be, in fact, nothing less than war against the United States. It is a fearful thing to lead this great, peaceful people into war. But right is more precious than peace. And we will fight for the things which we have always carried nearest our hearts. For democracy, for the rights and liberties of small nations, and for the belief that a worldwide union of free people can bring peace and safety to all nations.
President Wilson's emotional speech brought tears to the eyes of many of the lawmakers. They felt the great seriousness of his request. Outside, crowds lined the street to cheer Wilson as he returned to the White House from the Capitol building. He sat in his car and shook his head sadly. "Think of what it is they are cheering," he said. "My message today was a message of death for our young men. How strange it seems they would cheer that." On April 6th, 1917, Congress approved a declaration of war against Germany.
The Allies, Britain, France, and Russia, welcomed American involvement. The war was going badly for them. It had been very costly in lives, money, and supplies. Allied shipping was suffering heavy losses from German submarine attacks. A British naval blockade had greatly reduced food shipments to Germany. Now, Britain itself faced dangerously low supplies of food. Allied representatives went to Washington to explain what the Allies needed. They needed supplies, especially food, immediately. They needed money to pay for the supplies. They needed ships to get the supplies from America to Europe. And they needed American soldiers.
President Wilson and Congress worked together to organize the United States for war. Congress gave Wilson new wartime powers. He soon formed a council to build ships, improve industrial production, and control national transportation. He formed an agricultural agency to increase food production and food exports. And he formed an information committee to build public support for the war. Wilson's efforts succeeded. The Allies quickly got the ships, supplies, and money they requested. Most important, they soon got American soldiers.
Allied military leaders said only about 500,000 troops were needed from the United States. But American officials decided to build a much larger army. Before long, large numbers of American soldiers were crossing the Atlantic Ocean. They would fight the Germans on the western battlefronts of Europe. The extra strength they gave the Allies would play a major part in helping defeat Germany. That will be our story next week here on Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. You can read and listen to the stories that you have heard on today's program on our website. Once again, it's learningenglish.voanews.com. And we'd like to hear from you. Send us an email with your thoughts. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. Next week on Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition, we'll have part two of Pete Musto's report on the difficulties of part-time professors in American colleges and how some universities are dealing with them. And Anna Mateo will tell us about expressions and words with the word self in them in her weekly report on words and their stories. Jonathan Evans will be here tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with As It Is Monday, the weekday Learning English broadcast, webcast, and podcast from the Voice of America.